all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today. We have a great author to talk to, a staff sergeant from the U.S. Army, 6 years, Michael Cook. Michael, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, you have written a book called Life and Death at Abbey Gate. It's really not only about the fall of Afghanistan, but the operation to save Afghanistan, individuals, getting them out through the gate, but also afterwards. So that's really what we're going to talk about. The book is published by Casemate. But let's start with a little background. You're a guy who went to Eastern Michigan University primarily to play hockey, if I understood reading you right. Later on said, well, you know what, I'm gonna join the U.S. Army. Kind of an unusual step at that point. Tell us why you did it.
Yeah, I grew up a local guy here in Michigan, growing up in Ann Arbor and then going to Eastern Michigan. So, you know, hockey was always a big part of my life, as it is with many people in this area, right? So I think I always had that camaraderie, that team feel in my life through my hockey experiences. So then once I graduated college and moved out to California, I kind of lost that. So I was out there for about 5 or 6 years and was just feeling like I really needed something more, like I needed to be a part of a greater organization. And that's really what I think led me to down to the recruiter's office down in Huntington Beach, California. So went in, talked to the Marine recruiter, talked to the Army recruiter, decided that Army was the branch that I was more interested in, and started pursuing a career with them.
And you talk a little bit about your MOS. You were an engineer, a battalion, I think, in construction. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yep, so I was an engineer. 12 Whiskey is the designator that I started at. So mainly we did all the Army's construction work, or, you know, security or anything like that, anything that would need to be built or erected, essentially. Engineers do that job. So that's what most of our training consisted around. And then on our deployment to Afghanistan in 2019 and 2020, that's primarily what we were doing, is just building B-huts like barracks or joint operations centers, or, you know, fences for security, whatever the military needed from us, we built it.
Yeah, and while the general population, you know, 99% of the U.S. population doesn't serve, they only think of guys in the Army with, you know, toting a rifle going forward at the pointy end of the spear. But somebody back here is building stuff, cooking meals, doing all the logistics things, taking care of the mechanics on tanks and planes and what have you. So we don't think much about what the construction engineers are doing. So you probably find that pretty frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in the military has a specialty, right? So there's a million jobs that need to be done. So we just have to make sure that we have guys in the field of operations that are able to complete those tasks when needed.
And it's really through that effort of being an Army engineer that you came to work with a couple of Afghanistan men and got to know them and their families. Set that up a little bit, because it's really the cornerstone of the rest of the story.
Yeah, so when I was in Afghanistan in 2019 and 20, the first part of my deployment was up in a city called Mazar-e-Sharif, which is the second largest city in Afghanistan. It's in northern Afghanistan, right on the side of the Hindu Kush Mountains. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my whole life. And on that base, we were stationed on a NATO base up there that was ran by the German forces. But on that base, there was two men, two Afghan nationals named Abdul and Mohammed, who I developed a very strong relationship with. Started as a working relationship and turned into a friendship. So they were contractors, and they would essentially supply us with whatever materials that we would need to accomplish our mission. So, you know, going through like the military pipeline of getting materials while you're in Afghanistan can be very time consuming. It could take, you know, multiple weeks or months to get things, but these guys could get them there on like the next day, right? So they were very useful to us. We worked with them every single day, but they also took really good care of us. So they would bring us home-cooked meals from their wives, just because they knew that we were, you know, eating deployment food for a whole year. So like I said, it just really turned into a friendship, and they took great care of us. So when I left Mazar-e-Sharif to move on to my next base in Afghanistan, you know, I went in and said goodbye to them, and it was pretty much with the understanding that we were never going to see each other again. Not knowing what was coming down the road, right? Not knowing that the Taliban was going to recapture Afghanistan in summer of 2021. So that's kind of to tee it up how the relationship started with them.
And if I understand it right, these men, Abdul and Muhammad, were brother-in-laws.
Yes, that's correct.
So there's a tight family relationship among them, and you and your team were, some of them were at least brought into that and got that sense, I take it.
Yes, absolutely.
And as time goes on and you're out of Afghanistan, but in 2020, a year later or so, you begin to see what's going to happen. Walk us through kind of what you were watching from the outside and had concerns about.
Yeah, so obviously the Taliban starts encroaching on all of Afghanistan and taking perimeter cities slowly as they march towards Kabul. By this point, all U.S. troops have left Afghanistan. We've made the decision to give up Bagram, probably the most strategic base in all of Asia and the Middle East. And you know, when I look back on it, on my deployment, I can see signs of where things were going wrong. Right, like I was there during the Doha Agreement that Trump signed, and I remember the Afghan contractors that were there coming up to me after hearing about it and saying, sir, like, you can't leave, because if you guys leave, we're all going to be slaughtered, is exactly what one of them said. And again, I couldn't see the writing on the wall, but they could see it so clearly. Like, they knew exactly what was going to happen. You know, all of our intelligence assets were saying that the Afghan National Army, the Afghan government that we put in place, was going to be able to hold up after we left for, you know, different periods of time. But most of them said, you know, a year, 5 years, 10 years, infinite. Of course, all of them are wrong, because, you know, as soon as we left, the Taliban took control of the country in, I think, 5 days or something.
It happened so fast, and I would say the American planning was so bad that these inevitabilities just crashed upon the Afghan nationals that had been working with the U.S. military, didn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in my book, I do a deep dive into, you know, exactly what the failures were at the highest levels, as well as doing a deep dive into what the DOD report says happened versus what, you know, boots on the ground were saying that happened. But there's just so many failures at the highest levels that, you know, we ended up paying for in blood, unfortunately.
Well, in your words, in the book, the withdrawal was a clusterfuck. And everybody knows it was, and unfortunately a lot of Afghan nationals had to live with that cluster. This is everybody from interpreters and translators and drivers, and as Abdul and Muhammad were, folks working on the construction side, materials, logistics. I mean, it's a pretty big group of people, plus their family members, that are sort of left in the lurch, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, those people are a lot of those people are still there. You know, hundreds of thousands of our allies are still stuck there, and they're, a lot of them are in hiding and on the run from the Taliban, because if they get caught, there's a very, very strong likelihood that them and their families will be killed. So
there was something created, and we're talking to Michael Cook, author of Life and Death at Abbey Gate. Michael, there was something created called the Special Immigrant Visas, SIV. I don't know that the general public actually understands what that was supposed to be and how it actually worked.
Yeah. So the Special Immigrant Visa, commonly referred to as the SIV, was a visa that came into existence in the early 2000s, I believe, during the Iraq War. And essentially, the visa was supposed to get awarded to our local allies that have worked with us for a certain amount of years. I want to say it's 2 years. So if you're an Iraqi, if you're an Afghan, and you devote your service to the United States and help us against our enemies, we're going to make sure that you're protected should you ever need protecting, and we'll bring you here to the United States under a special immigrant visa. That was the point of it. The program was wildly unsuccessful because they just weren't prepared for the amount of people that were going to be applying. Again, just back to very poor government planning at the highest levels. So due to the influx of applicants and not enough resources to process them, that's, you know, why so many of them got left behind in those summer months of August 2021.
Well, and some of it was just, you know, whoever planned this thing or thought this thing through, You had to prove up that two-year status. You had to prove up how important you were to the American cause. It's not like there was somebody sitting at a desk cranking out paperwork on the computer system, was there?
No, and one of the big problems, actually, was that a lot of paperwork got lost. So these contractors or these Afghan allies that were working for, like, a third party, like an American contractor, you know, anytime those contractors would go out of business, all that paperwork would be lost. So now we get stuck with this position where we have these Afghan allies that have devoted their lives to the United States and helping us while we're overseas. And now we don't have any of their paperwork to prove that they're qualified for these visas. So just one of the failures.
Yeah, there's this view that, well, we'll vet people. Well, if there's no paperwork or not a cooperating government, you can't vet them. There's no way to do this. And while this maybe made sense in creating the SIV program, boy, it did not work at all, did it?
No, it was I sat down with Senator Blumenthal after the evacuation and when I was writing my book, and he straight up told me that the system is completely broken and needs to be rebuilt from the ground up.
You talk in the book about what happens at Abbey Gate and also talk about kind of what happens afterwards, the digital Dunkirk I want to talk about. But give us your view on what happened at Abbey Gate there in August of 2021.
Yeah, so I guess there's a few ways to go down that path. But Abbey Gate was essentially an entrance at the Hamid Karzai International Airport, which is in Kabul. It's the civilian airport that's at Kabul. That's the airport that the U.S. government decided to run the evacuation out of. Why we decided to run it out of there, a civilian airport, and not Bagram, a military base that was very well fortified, is a big mystery. But essentially, yeah, Abbey Gate was one of the main gates where a lot of people ended up escaping, but also was the site of the suicide bomber, the ISIS-K suicide bomber that ended up killing 13 of our troops.
And it was just utter confusion at the gate. There was no good way to get good people out. While a lot of people evacuated over that week, not nearly enough, which sort of left people like Abdul and Muhammad in this position of getting in touch with old friends like yourself and saying, what can you do for me?
Yep.
How did that develop, and walk us through that couple of days of craziness trying to make something work thousands of miles away?
Yeah, so I had kept in touch with Abdul Mohammed via WhatsApp after deployment. So, communication kind of slowed a little bit in the years that that passed. But then, July and August of 2021, when the Taliban's coming up on Kabul, is really when our communication picked up heavily. So at that point, both men and their families had fled from Mazar Sharif down to Kabul, because that was the last remaining stronghold of the Afghan National Army and the Afghan government. So the Taliban essentially had them surrounded, as well as all of our allies surrounded. So I get a call from, or a FaceTime from Abdul, and I'll never forget it, because he was holding his little daughter, his baby daughter, and I'm sitting in my kitchen with my mother, and we're FaceTiming. And, I remember my mother had to step off screen because she was just so devastated, because she understood what was about to happen, not only to Abdul Mohammed, but to their families and their daughters. You know, these daughters are, if they survive, they're going to grow up in a country where they're not allowed to go to school, they're not allowed to work, they're not allowed to leave their homes without a male escort or without their faces covered. I mean, their entire futures are being stripped from them in the moment that we're having this phone conversation. So that was obviously very tough, but Abdul just, essentially asked if I could help him find a way out. And that's really when we started looking into the visas and found the special immigrant visa process. So I reached out to Senator Debbie Stabenow here in Michigan. Her and her team were amazing and very helpful in trying to expedite the process of getting these visas going. Unfortunately, there just wasn't time to get a visa in those short weeks, right? I mean, it can take years. And a lot of people that applied for SIVs still don't have case numbers today, years later. So at that point, we pretty much just knew we needed to make a run for the airport, because even, Debbie Stabenow was set up for failure by the State Department, because the guidance that she was getting and passing on to me was have them shelter at home, wait for the call to get their visas, and then they can proceed to the airport. Well, like I just said, that was never going to happen. So at that point, we knew we had to make a run for the airport. And, they had a pretty disastrous first run at the airport. They ran into a Taliban checkpoint. Mohammed got roughed up real good. They beat him with their rifles. And when I ended up seeing him a few months later, he was still covered head to toe in bruising. So at that point, we knew we needed to make some deeper connections. And that's really what led to the Digital Dunkirk network of people, essentially the underground group of people that were working online, veterans and civilians alike, just to try to find ways to help these Afghan allies get out of the country.
And this Digital Dunkirk network is working outside, really, the U.S. government process, if I understand it.
It was. I mean, there was a lot of active duty military, and there are a lot of veterans, so a lot of guys and girls that understood the processes that would need to take place, but weren't subjected to the same red tape that a government evacuation was. So we were able to kind of run a little loose outside the lines, which was a lot more effective than whatever the government was doing.
And you go through in the book, which is an easy, good, informative read, Life and Death at Abbey Gate, you go through talk about various individuals who helped along this process, because you were stumbling in the dark. You didn't know how to make this happen. And everybody was learning from everybody else. And a line I wrote down was about the individual courage displayed, not only by the Afghan nationals, but also by civilian veterans, active duty military, that individual courage, which was running up against the inept bureaucracy. It had to be frustrating.
Yeah, it was. And like you said, we didn't really know what we were doing. We just knew that it had to happen fast. So I think one line in my book is we were building the airplane mid-flight is essentially what we were trying to do. So we were setting up all these essentially joint operation centers online through all these encrypted messaging apps, and just passing information as fast as possible on what was happening at the airport in different ways.
And there's a whole range of people who help out on this? I mean, some sort of big names, maybe bigger influences than others, but a whole range of people are helping on this effort that not only you are engaged with, but you know, tens of thousands of other Afghan nationals are trying to get out.
Yeah. I mean, it took everybody. If you were useful, you were put to work. So whether that meant you were a famous politician or just some veteran like myself that deployed to Afghanistan a couple years prior, everyone was put to work and did whatever they could to help.
This was a 24/7 exhaustive effort, as you were writing about what you're trying to do and the time zone differences. And I just felt reading it how exhausted you were, but how exhausted Abdul and Muhammad and their family was.
Yeah, and I can't even imagine, because I do remember how tired I was, because, you know, when it's daytime over there, it's nighttime here. So I stayed up every single night for probably a week in a row, and I was exhausted, but I kept putting myself in their shoes. I mean, they're being hunted by a brutal enemy and just trying to escape with their lives, you know, and adding small children into that equation is just terrifying for any American to even think about. But that's the situation that they were in. So I knew, and everyone else working on it knew, that there was nothing that was going to stop us. So we had to give everything we had.
And it was really some active duty military, Marines and others who are sort of violating or bending protocol to make some of this work. And that's an amazing part of the story, that those men and women, active duty men and women, ought to get credit for their humanity and what they're doing right for the country.
Absolutely. I mean, I hate to say that a lot of the Marines were set up for failure at the gates as well, but they really were. I mean, the State Department just really botched this evacuation, and they just weren't the Marines that were at the front lines were not given the proper guidance to execute this evacuation properly. So, yeah, like you said, a lot of times they had to kind of go against policy and just do what they knew was right to save lives. So I was just so proud to share the same uniform as those men and women that stood on the front lines at Abbey Gate.
I do want to say, before we run out of time, that Abdul and Muhammad and the family was able to get out and relocate. Give us that synopsis quickly.
Yeah, thank you for asking. They're doing great. I won't say exactly where they live, but they live very close to me. I get to see them constantly. I'm going over to their house this weekend for dinner. Kids are doing great and are fluently speaking English, and they're in school and playing soccer, and you know, the men each have jobs and they're have their own apartments, so they're doing fantastic, and we're just so happy to have them here safely.
Well, it's an American success story, and we hope they embrace it, enjoy it. Michael Cook, author of Life and Death at Abbey Gate. If somebody wants to read your very candid, straightforward account of the fall of Afghanistan, the operation to save our allies, where can they find the book?
Yeah, anywhere you buy your books, Amazon, obviously, Barnes & Noble. You can go to my website, which is michaelcook.com. That's M-I-K-A-E-L, cook.com, and you can purchase it there as well.
Well, your service to the country and the Army was really quite noble, but more importantly, the work you did afterwards to honor a commitment made to these Afghan nationals and their families is even more noteworthy. So, Michael, we are very happy to have you here on Veterans Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed that conversation.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org.
And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Presscorn Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We appreciate all your support. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsor level, and continue to support keeping Veterans Radio on the air. And until next time, you are dismissed.